so stupid. He comes across in front of me every single time he overtakes. Where does he want me to go off the track?
No!
Stop talking to me in the braking zone.
New main event announced for WrestleMania 33. Sebastian Vettel versus Daniel Kvyat in a no handbags botch. Welcome back to Motorsport 101. You are the world champion! Good evening, everybody. I am Andre Harrison, and welcome to episode 36 of Motorsport 101. It's a glorious 8:30 p.m. evening here as we record this new episode, as ever, alongside Mr. Adam Johnson.
Good evening. We seem to be getting later and later by the week in terms of recording. We'll be literally pulling the all-night session soon. I like to think we're recording this. Number one, we're recording this on American time because we are basically all American.
Of course.
And two, we're recording this in the slot I like to call, I have an excuse to stay off Twitter and avoid raw London spoilers. So we're all good.
That's as good a reason as any, right there. Quite frankly, and yes, I do pretty much live on American time, so I'm not even denying this for a second. Quite frankly, and in the actual American, Mr. Ryan King, hello, sir.
Yeah, wait a second. I need to secure my ride away from Rio Harianto, so I'll be back.
He's gone out to start a
text
crowdfunding
SMS
campaign.
Now. Yeah. Text an SMS now, and you will pledge £3 a month to get Ryan King into a manor seat.
The world is not ready for Ryan King in an actual Formula One car. He's probably the best driver ever. We just don't know it yet because he's fucking clever. Yeah.
And my Snapchats are going to be guaranteed better than Lewis's. I don't care. FOM ain't shutting me down.
Straight fire.
Ryan King out here saying, smash the system. He's a rebel without a cause.
He'll be dropping CM Punk pipe bombs from in the paddock. Paddock pipe bomb.
Yep, he's going to scrout to Romain Grosjean and take no shit. Also, that's £2 in the swear jar now. Ching. God damn it, Dre. Yeah, it keeps going up to £9 already after three episodes. This is not a good start. This is going to get expensive if this keeps up. As I was saying, episode 36 is a lengthy one, and there's a lot to talk about, actually. We'll be opening up with a breaking news MotoGP story, or what it was at the time of recording, anyway. By the time you're listening to this, it won't have been, but yes, he's actually gone and done the damn thing. Jorge Lorenzo is a Ducati rider for 2017.
He listened we'll to talk us. About this. He listened to our show.
Yeah, I like to take credit for this. Like, the only reason he's joined because he listened to the wisdom of Adam Johnson, and therefore he thought Ducati was the right move. Way to go, Adam. Way to go.
You'll thank me later, Jorge.
I want a cut of the profits, quite frankly. pledge to our Patreon. We'll get you a free T-shirt. We had the Formula One Chinese Grand Prix this past weekend, and Nico Rosberg wins again, his sixth consecutive race win. Only the fourth driver in the history of the sport to win six races in a row. Went a dominant 38-second victory over Sebastian Vettel in second place. And we'll be talking about his beef with Daniil Kvyat in the arguably most overrated big news story to come out of the Chinese Grand Prix since, well, ever, really. Seb in the wars again, but we'll talk about that as well. And, there was some actual beef between Romain Grosjean and Marcus Ericsson. Just imagine a French word swear. Just imagine a Frenchman swearing like an Englishman. That's pretty much what Romain Grosjean did. We'll talk about that later. We'll talk about Lewis Hamilton, who's now 36 points off of Nico Rosberg in the championship fight. And with Toto Wolff already backing Hamilton to back that lead up, we ask, is Hamilton already out of the running? That's fake drama. I mean, it means you'll listen in later. We'll also be talking about some other stories outside of the Chinese Grand Prix, such as Rio Haryanto going back to the crowdfunding circus. That's sure to go over well. We'll talk about Alfa Romeo and the possibility that they may be buying out Sauber and more negative press regarding the team going forward. We'll also talk about the fact that this race was the lowest watched Formula One race for a decade, which is very intriguing indeed, and more draconian FOM activity as they're going after gift makers. Yes, this
those
is actually
those dastardly
happening.
Gift makers.
They're taking money out of the company's pockets, Johnson.
This is like that poem, isn't it? First they came for the modders and we said nothing. Then they went after Ryzen Studios, and we did nothing. Then they went after the gift makers, and we said nothing. Actually, we said a lot because we're Motorsport 101.
Yeah. Next, I'll be coming after this podcast. Wait, let's move on quickly. We'll be talking about IndyCar as well. They had the Grand Prix yesterday as Simon Pagenaud took his first ever win for the Penske team. In controversial fashion, we'll be talking in depth about Cutgate and why Paul Tracy is a meathead. We'll also be talking about the context of Pagenaud's first win and has he finally put it all together. And the other big story coming out of IndyCar this past week, the universal consensus by a lot of the drivers, that's a bad choice of words there. I need to hire a thesaurus. Anyway, we'll be talking about how Joseph Newgarden, Tony Kanaan, Graham Rahal, and James Hinchcliffe all pretty much said in unison that the race was boring and they're calling for change. We'll be talking about that. I'll give you a hint. It may or may not have something to do with the aero kits. Just a thought. And finally, we'll also be talking about the esports potential of Formula One itself after AOR's big season finale yesterday, which I'm sure many of you listening to this probably watched last night. 750 people tuned in for an F1 2013 race on Twitch. That's pretty mental. So that and inevitably much more in this upcoming episode of Motorsport 101. And we will begin with, at the time of recording, a breaking news story, Johnson. Like I said, he's done the damn thing. Jorge Lorenzo has signed a 2-year deal to join Ducati. And, well, AJ, I think this was, I think, kind of expected. It is, I think there was too many rumors going around for this not to have at least an air of truth about it. But today, we found out it was an official announcement. It's a 2-year deal for Lorenzo at Ducati. And I think we're all pretty much unanimously saying it seems like the right thing to do.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a difference between why call Audi rumors, as in rumors that just keep coming up out of nowhere because people want them to be true. And the reason why I call it the Audi rumors is because I base it off the whole Audi to F1 rumors that went around for about 2 years straight.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Even though there was never any proof that anything was ever going to happen. It was literally based on my mate's cousin's granddad told me that someone he knows at Audi's next door neighbors, something or other. And then you've got the no smoke without fire type rumors like the Lorenzo one, as we've seen, where it just keeps coming up and too many decent sources keep saying, you know, when you've got Motorcycle News and David Emmett of Moto Matters breaking constant stories about how this could be a deal and how it's coming together, it's almost too much to ignore. And I think what's interesting is that we all agreed that this ultimately could be the best move that Lorenzo could ever make. It relies on Ducati stepping up, but I think ultimately, what has Lorenzo got to lose at this point? If he wins another title on a Yamaha, we agreed, not really going to do much to his legacy. And hey, he's still going to be playing number two to the Valentino Rossi circus. So why not go to Ducati and maybe put himself down as an all-time legend?
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously a big shout out to David Emmett over at Moto Matters. He was the lead source for this story pretty much all the way through. If you're a bike fan, you're not following David Emmett on Twitter at Moto Matters, I don't know what you're doing with your life, because he is a fantastic source, a great writer, great journalist. He does everything the right way. And I've said it before, MotoGP's press department is a lot better than Formula One's. I've said this time and time again. The F1 press makes up half its crap. Like, MotoGP, the people who know, and they really do. And again, David was a great source of information regarding this. And I can't disagree with anything Johnson said, really. I look at this like it's a game-changing move for Lorenzo, and I think one that he needs to make for his own self-esteem. We all know he's arguably the best rider on the planet today. He's won 3 championships with Yamaha. He's spent the last, he debuted there 2007, I want to say. So he's done 8 years with them already as it is. This will be his 9th year with Yamaha. And for the vast majority of those years, It was the Valentino Rossi entourage, and it still is by the sounds of it, because, you know, the man is gospel. Whatever he says, people listen, and that's just the nature of the sport that, you know, has had him as its most prominent figure for arguably 15 years now. And, you know, the only time I think, you know, the team really was Lorenzo's is when Ben Spies was his teammate. Sorry, King. That probably brings up painful memories of the Ben Spies era at Yamaha, but we need more Americans in the sport, clearly. But King, I mean, I can only echo what Johnson said. I think it's a great move for him. I think the potential there is huge. I think, you know, having the extra money is you know, can't hurt either. I think there isn't really, for me, a major negative behind this move. And I feel like, you know, he's got nothing to lose and potentially everything to gain by doing this.
Yeah, I mean, I have to agree with both of you. I think where to look now is what next? Who's going to be his teammate at Ducati? Because apparently Ducati's not getting a third bike. So one of the drivers, I mean, one of the riders currently at Ducati is getting the sack. And who's replacing Jorge Lorenzo at Yamaha? And apparently everyone, including yourself last week, says Maverick Vinales is probably going to get that seat next year.
Although, didn't Bike Live's Lewis Sutterby pitch an alternative suggestion of Espargaro? Paul Espargaro?
Paul Espargaro is a rider that, when he joined MotoGP after he won the MotoGP, the year afterwards, he was given a Yamaha factory contract with the team when he got debut, which pissed off Bradley Smith a great deal, because Bradley was there at the time already, because he was Crutchlow's partner. I think it was Crutchlow's teammate at the time, basically. And what happened was that Bradley felt like he was kicked to the curb when he felt like he could have had a potential to be on that seat, because Espargaro came in and was given a factory deal, but which basically everybody at that point penciled him in as the future Rossi replacement, because Rossi was on the last year of his current deal at that point in time anyway. So it all seemed to make sense that Espargaro was going to be the next guy. And he still could be the next guy for all we know, because Paul's actually had a very good start to the 2016 season. He seems to have bounced back after what was a pretty poor 2015 campaign, where Bradley Smith beat him from pillar to post, pretty much. So the theory that Lewis made on Twitter, for you follow him, my Bike Life partner in crime, at Lewis Sutterby 23, must follow, by the way. It was a very sound theory, in my opinion, where, you know, he was basically saying that Paul gets the seat Lorenzo leaves behind for the time being, and that would free the way for Alex Rins to potentially go to Tech 3 and wait for a Rossi retirement, and then Rins gets the seat. And the next thing you know, Yamaha's got a partnership of Espargaro and Rins, and it's a very dangerous-looking team. You have Espargaro as the more experienced name, and you have Rins as the potential young hotshot. It makes sense, Johnson, but I think Maverick's just too big a prospect to ignore. That could be your franchise guy for the next decade. I think it's too big a golden carrot for Yamaha to ignore at this point.
See, I feel like a lot of this is going to come down to just how much power Rossi has over the new guy coming in. If it's Agreed. More a focus on developmental, if it's more focus on a number two rider, then I don't know. Does that swing it towards Espargaro? It depends on, to a degree, you know, it feels like it depends to a degree on just how much would be an immediate threat to Rossi. But Vinales would be a supreme talent. And then if you bring Rins into the equation once Rossi's gone, that's a supreme like lineup for the next few years. But I mean, is there any way that they shuffle Espargaro out so that slot at Tech 3 is still able to be filled by Rins, but they bring Vinales in as well? It's almost like there's too many young prospects to move around. This almost feels to me like the Formula One silly season we could have had last year had Kimi Raikkonen retired at the end of last year or left Ferrari. We were all wondering just who would be the one to move up to Ferrari and then who would move in at Haas or Sauber or wherever. In the end, Raikkonen extended his deal. None of that happened. Now we've got Lorenzo, who's left probably the best overall team in MotoGP right now. You've got the prospect of being teammate to Rossi, of all people, and it's suddenly setting this. I mean, this could be a total like domino effect. This could set off a real Absolutely. Chain effect. So it's interesting. I think, who do you choose on Raw Pastry? Are you feeling Vinales?
I think, see, here's the thing. Like, I think the 2016 rules which have come into effect this year with the Michelin tires and the standardized electronics for the entire field, I think it's just made the factory gap all the bigger between them and the satellite team. So I feel like Maverick going to Tech 3 might actually be a step backwards, which is amazing when you consider that Tech 3 right now have basically got the same bike Lorenzo won the championship with just 6 months ago, which is just crazy when it comes to how far progression the field has made already, despite these new packages and new tires and whatnot. But on raw pace, I feel like Maverick is a better prospect prospect going forward. I think the fact he's 5 years younger than Pol is a big plus as well for a team, because if he's going to be loyal to the team, your window is so much bigger with Maverick than it is with Polis Bagaro. And like the black mark against Pol is that he was beaten really badly by Bradley Smith last season. So for me, if I'm Lynn Jarvis right now, I'm giving Maverick a call saying, what's it going to take? Quite frankly, like how much money do we have to throw at you to lock you down for a 3 or 4 year deal, quite frankly, which is kind of rare for MotoGP, because normally it's a 2 year deal we get in MotoGP. They like to think in the short term. You don't normally get a 1 or a 2 year kind of deal. It's like the NFL or the NBA where they'll tie you down to 5 year, $100+ million contracts. It's not like that in MotoGP. You're lucky if a contract goes beyond 2 years. So for me, I think it's Maverick. I know King alluded to Ian Oni yesterday because he thinks Ian Oni might get the chop out of that. So basically, whoever Ducati cut, Yamaha could snipe, and especially if it's Dovi, because I think Dovi is universally respected as like one of the best developmental riders you could have. Like he's excellent when it comes to rider feedback. So there's another prospect as well. I mean, King, is your opinion swayed on this? Are you still adamant on the whoever gets cut from Ducati camp on this?
Yeah, I'm still adamant on whoever gets cut from Ducati, because Rossi is still Rossi.
Yeah, it's a very good point. Like I know, I also want to give a shout out to Danny Brennan about this, because Brennan mentioned this on the chat in the last episode, and he had a very fair point about Pol Espargaró, because mostly for the reason of he doesn't think Pol's good enough to beat Valentino anyway, and he's thinking, I'm guessing, if I'm using his logic, a reminder of the Honda camp right now, with obviously that bike is obviously Marquez's entity, and Marquez is just that frigging good right now, and Pedrosa is basically a accidental number two, in the sense of he'll clean up the mess of a Marquez if he goes wrong, and he'll still pick up solid points. He may even win on the odd occasion, but we all know it's Marquez's team, really. And Pedrosa is like the beatable number two that's not really going to be a threat to the main guy. I mentioned this before as well about how often having two title contenders in the same team may often be counterproductive, because they beat each other up and they let somebody else come through. So I think King makes a valid point. I think Johnson kind of alluded to the same thing, really. I think, you know, riders that could upset Rossi's apple cart is probably going to be off the table, and who knows just how good Maverick Vinales really is. He's done fantastic work on that Suzuki. I mean, we mentioned it last week. It was a career high finish in fourth place at COTA last weekend, and yeah, there's a lot of potential prospects on the table. Again, if now the deal is done, again, feel free to comment on the stream if you guys have an opinion on this. I'd love to hear you guys take on the whole thing, because there's so many different ways you can look at it. Again, like I said last week, and who knows what could go on there. Right. As Johnson just in the chat, we've already gone nearly 20 minutes. God damn it. These things go quick. So Formula One, and we're going to talk about the Chinese Grand Prix. And holy crap, Nico Rosberg is on a tear right now. He is ridiculous. And I mentioned this in the intro as well, that this is the sixth consecutive win for Nico Rosberg. He's only the fourth driver ever to have done this. Michael Schumacher had a six-race winning streak at his prime in 2004. Alberto Ascari has a seven-race win streak, and obviously Sebastian Vettel is the all-time leader there with nine in the 2013 season. But King, how smug are you right now, being a known Rosberg fan, that your boy has actually made a bit of history and has now got six consecutive wins on the table?
Oh, he also made another bit of history. He is now the winningest driver to not win a championship, or let's just say yet to win a championship.
Ooh. Oh, go on. King, are you calling your shot right here?
I really want to, but the more, you know, rational side of my brain is saying, no, don't be silly. That is stupid. We're only three races in.
Yeah, that's the funny thing about it. As we mentioned earlier in the show, Rosberg now has a 36-point lead on he's never had 36 points on any point during the three and a bit years they've been together in Formula One. Rosberg now 36 points clear of Lewis Hamilton, almost outscoring him 2-1 so far, which again, you would never imagine us saying that 2 years ago when Hamilton was on a tear and won 11 races in 2014. And just like this, just like that, Johnson, like, Hamilton's had obviously had a bad run of form in terms of, you know, outside incidents and whatnot having an impact on the race, obviously. In Australia, he was barged out at turn one a little bit, was a little bit unlucky where that's concerned. In Bahrain, again, he was given the pole driver by Valtteri Bottas, and you know that crippled his car. He had to limp home in third. This time again, engine failure but engine issues in qualifying, which forced him to start from the back and had to come through to finish in seventh. And again, had a damaged car. The floor was damaged because Felipe Nasr hit him on turn one. So Hamilton's had a bad run of form, but even so, Rosberg is flying right now, Johnson. It's incredibly impressive.
The absolutely crucial thing to keep in mind here is that, you know, it's easy to say, oh, well, Hamilton's had a bad run of form. And yes, he has. Things have not fallen his way. Ever since he got that miserable launch off the line in Australia, things just haven't clicked so far for Hamilton. But here's the absolutely crucial part. What Rosberg is doing now that he wasn't able to do before is maximizing his chances when Hamilton has an off day. The thing is, in 2014 and 2015, when Hamilton did have an off day, Rosberg normally did as well. Like, for example, in Singapore, when Hamilton was well off the pace, so was Rosberg. And, you know, I'm trying to think, like Hungary, for example, you know, at that race, that was a race where Hamilton had mistakes. He got wrapped up in instants. He was off in the gravel on the first lap. That was a race that Rosberg should have. Yeah, he had an awful day. Rosberg should have won that race. Did he even get the podium? I want to say he got like second or third in the end.
Rosberg finished eighth that day. Hamilton finished sixth.
Like, exactly. There you go. There's your prime example. That was a day where Rosberg had to win, and he actually ended up finishing behind Hamilton in his worst performance of the year. So this is the big difference now. Rosberg is finally being able to nail the points on the board when he's finally got that really kind of clinical streak about him, which is what Hamilton's had the last few years. He's finally got that really nice, like, nail your start, nail your strategy, don't make any silly mistakes, just take control of the race and make it your own. It doesn't matter. I mean, in this race in China, he actually got beaten by Ricciardo off the line, and he was around him within a few laps and away, and he was gone. I mean, of course, Ricciardo had a puncture. Even so, you could tell Rosberg was right there and he had the pace, but it just feels to me like I do wonder if those wins at the end of last year really helped to build some confidence. And I actually go back to COTA last year. I just wonder if since then we've seen a slightly different Rosberg. It felt to me like at that COTA weekend, he had enough. Something in him snapped. It was like he went, you know what? I'm fed up of being second to Hamilton all the time. I'm fed up of being pushed around by him. I'm fed up of him feeling like he can just barge me out of pole on the first corner and that's it. I'm fed up of making silly mistakes and costing myself winning positions against him. No more. We've got to cut this stuff out. That was why there was the whole hat gate after the race. You know, that was Rosberg. He was annoyed. He'd let another championship slip away versus his teammate, who he felt by that point could run roughshod over him. So ever since then, it's felt to me like Rosberg has really gone kind of, you know what? It doesn't matter who's on the other side of the garage. I'm going to focus on having the best possible race myself, and that will bring it to me. And since then, it's been on an absolute blinder. I mean, Hamilton will dismiss the last three races of last year as, hey, he backed off. It was, you know, the championship was won. I don't buy that for a second. If you're a race driver in a race car, you want to win every race you're in. Especially listen, someone like Hamilton. Go on.
Listen, remember Abu Dhabi when they put Hamilton on the Super towards the end and he was moaning at his engineer like, all that does not sound like a guy that doesn't want to win a Grand Prix and doesn't really care.
Exactly.
Like I'm not buying what Hamilton's selling on that at all. And if anything, Hamilton's tried to play the whole thing down since this winning streak has happened. And like any smart athlete would, they're not going to embrace Rosberg's six race winning streak and say, oh yeah, he's doing brilliant right now. He might be better than I am finally. He's turned the corner. You're not going to say that. You're never going to say that about your main title rival. Of course you're not. But at the same time, Hamilton's done his best to try and diminish this streak. And you know what? You can say what you will about Hamilton's bad luck. 25 points is still 25 points.
And Rosberg had to go and get them. That's the thing. In previous years, he would have finished second or third in a few of those races. He would have lost to Vettel. He would have found a way to trip up and not take every single point. But this year, he has.
point is this, right? We've had 41 hybrid era races since 2014. Mercedes has won 35 of them. And a lot of, as Johnson, I think, made an excellent point, where a lot of the time, where if Hamilton has a bad day, Rosberg has not cashed in his opportunities. Like you said, Singapore was a prime example of that last year. Hamilton had his one technical DNF for the season. Rosberg finished fourth, was only able to take 12 points out of him. The two times that Rosberg had a mechanical failure last year, the engine blowout at Monza and then the throttle failure at Russia, Hamilton won both times.
Absolutely.
Plus 50. Like, that's a plus 50 point swing. And not to mention, yeah, he can take the 12 away from Singapore. That's still plus 38 for the year in a season where Hamilton won by 59. So there's some maths there for you. But in any case, you're absolutely right. I think, you know, it's one thing for your teammate to have issues, but you still want to cash in these opportunities. And we've seen it six times in the last 2 years where if Rosberg has a bad, like if Hamilton has a bad day, the other guy might not necessarily take full advantage of it, because we've seen Vettel and Ricciardo win three races each in those off periods for Mercedes. So it's happened before, King. And going forward, like, I want to talk about Hamilton for a minute here. And again, like you've mentioned it a minute ago about the rational side of your brain kicking in about, you know, can Rosberg win this title now? And I was thinking about this the other day. And I mean, you may see me tweet about this at Harrison101HD about this, and on Facebook as well. And I speculate, because, you know, I, for those guys that don't know, I work in a bookmakers now at the time when I'm not making this podcast. And of course, you have a little sporting thoughts. I'm a big numbers guy, I always have been. So I had a question I posed to Twitter, and the question I posed was this: how many points would you have to give Rosberg as a handicap before you could confidently say he's going to win the championship? And I don't think anybody quite knew how to answer this. I did some thinking, I looked back at some numbers, did some stats, did some number crunching, as I do. I'm turning into Ted Kravitz slowly. It's not a good idea. I'm going to be wearing socks and sandals next week. It's going to be terrible. I'm going to, you know, start squashing some plates and, you know, using chocolate bars to describe tires. It's not good. King, what number would you put on this? Because you are a big numbers guy. You are a big Rosberg fan. We've seen the last two and a bit seasons. Where would you stand on this?
Oh, if he had to be amount of points clear, oh, my gut feeling, it'd have to be somewhere between 100, 150, like two or three races clear. Yeah.
150. So you're giving him six rounds.
Yeah. Because you got to remember, this is a 21 race season.
That's true.
It's a longer season, yeah.
That's true. There is a truth. It's a 21 race calendar. And the funny thing is that, I mean, you may have seen me already kind of spoil the game on this one, but I mentioned this on Facebook this morning that, again, Hamilton is 36 behind Rosberg. The number I came up with, and I clearly have more faith in your boy than you do, King, is the number I had was 35.5. And the reason why I said 30. The reason I said 35.5 is that Mercs are the dominant team. Assuming, right, that Mercs doesn't have any mechanical issues, like, you can't really factor that in. Like, assuming there's no mechanical issues, there is a 7-point difference between first and second. 25 points for a win, 18 for second. The differential in wins between the two has been 5 or 6 the last couple of seasons. Like 2014, Hamilton won 11 races. Rosberg won 5. Last year, Hamilton won 10. Rosberg won 6. So for me, I thought 5-1-2s, roughly 35 points. You know, Hamilton tends to win about 5 races more than Rosberg does. If you gave Rosberg a 35.5 point head start, I think he'd win the title overall. Johnson, you got 2 cents on this? King, go on.
Yeah, like hearing your numbers and thinking about my ultra conservative estimate was a bit too far on my end. I wouldn't go as low as yours, but I'd probably go, I'd have to probably go somewhere between 50 and 75.
Mm.
Well, she's still thinking 2 to 3 clear races. That's deep. Mm. I understand where you come from. Johnson, you got 2 cents on this real quick?
Well, I'm normally terrible at maths, so I'm still interested in the numbers anyway. And this is a very fascinating discussion. For me, I'm sort of in the 40 to 50 point mark, because I feel like what Rosberg has to do still is he just has to keep this pragmatism going. And what he has to be able to do, what will be the true test is when, because Hamilton's going to come back at him at some point. You get the feeling that of Hamilton course. Will come back with about one, two, maybe three race wins in a row. And if Rosberg can get seconds in each of those and stay hungry and then take another win or so, you know, it's good. I mean, last year, the thing is, in 2014, it was close throughout the year and it kind of seesawed throughout the way. And then, you know, things started to fall apart for Rosberg near the end of the season. 2015, he was behind the eight ball right from the get-go. And he, especially after the technical failures in, it got to a point where he was hanging on. And then those technical failures late in the season kind of killed his chances altogether. He's in the scenario where he's actually got head start. This is alien territory for Rosberg. You know, even in 2014, he didn't really amass that much of a lead, even when, you know, Hamilton DNF'd the first race. And, you know, a classic example, Hamilton DNF'd the first race of the hybrid era in Australia. Rosberg, I think, was what, second or third? Oh, no, didn't he win that race?
He won that race.
Sorry, yes, there you go, there you go. I was getting confused for a second.
He was plus 25 after the opening round and lost the title by 64 in the end.
Well, that was mostly on double points, wasn't it, the final round?
He lost 50 points on the double point retirement in Abu Dhabi, but he was minus 17 by the time the second to last round came around. That was Brazil, a race he won.
Yeah, and if I have to bring up another example, Canada that year, where both of them had brake-by-wire failures, but Hamilton was forced to retire, yet he was still able to somehow get a podium.
Yeah, exactly. Rosberg still finished second that day to the eventual winner, Daniel Ricciardo, his first win. So, yeah, like, there's many different ways you can look at this, and I think, again, like, I was the most generous of the three of us when it came to a handicap here. I gave 35, and Johnson and King were thinking 50+.
I'm thinking more just on the case of just the thing is what's going to be key. I think, Dre, your figure is accurate if Rosberg's pragmatism that he showed so far this season continues. If he's able to still pick up as many points as possible from every single round, you know, do what Leicester City have been forced to do in their title running, you know, just get points wherever. Even on the bad days, you still finish second. You still finish third. Yeah, just get the points wherever you can. I mean, Hamilton has still been able to do that to a degree so far this season. You know, you say limped home in second in Australia, limped home third in Bahrain. That's still very good for me. If that's off days for Hamilton, man.
Yeah.
But it was China where
you
really
win a championship on your bad days.
Exactly. So it's when Rosberg has his bad days that it will swing back. But if Rosberg keeps displaying this kind of pragmatism and really kind of level-headedness, I haven't seen Rosberg flustered at all this season. He's been absolutely smooth as anything. Same in the final three rounds of last year. As I say, I can't help but think that something changed in Rosberg last year at COTA. I don't, you know, I'm a little bit into the psychological side, but again, I think it's too much is made of it. But I think a little bit was made of maybe Rosberg took himself away from the intense inter-team personal feud between him and Hamilton, you know, being so desperate to beat Hamilton. I think Rosberg just said, right, it's all about me now and amassing as many points for me. I'm out there to beat 21 other drivers, not just Hamilton. And I think that seems to work well.
To be fair, Johnson as well, COTA was a race where Rosberg pretty much embarrassed himself. He was exposed in front of the entire American audience and as much as the UK audience as well. He threw away the championship. That was a race he was winning with five laps to go.
Exactly.
And he choked. He chokes. He almost gave up second to Sebastian Vettel that same Grand Prix. And that choke was what led to Hamilton winning the race and the title. Rosberg's still in contention if he wins that Grand Prix. So it was an awful situation where Rosberg had nobody to blame but himself for throwing away the last sliver of a hope he could win the title.
As I say, that's why he threw the hat back. It was frustration. He was annoyed with himself. He was furious.
He was blatantly mad of himself. And, you know, the last thing he needed on top of that was his team. Teammate, obviously on a high of winning the title, throw his cap back at him. You know, that's always going to piss a guy off. He's going to make you
just rubbing it in,
whatnot,
really.
You know, yeah.
And I mean, that was the last of like a couple of other just choke moments from Rosberg last season, where I remember in Bahrain, where, you know, Kimi Raikkonen just handed him, and he just made a mistake, ran off the road.
Yeah, it's a very good point. Rosberg's had those moments where he has bottled it on occasions. I mean, there was a reason why they labeled him Bottleberg because of incidents like that. So seeing Rosberg on this winning streak only fills me with hope for the season going forward. Again, if you've got a number for the handicap and why, again, leave a comment. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this one. So it's a very, very interesting discussion. On the opposite side of that, Sebastian Vettel and Daniil Kvyat. Now, turn one, there was a big incident there. Well, you know, because, you know, all turn one incidents tend to be these days. But Daniil Kvyat gets a lightning start from P6 on the grid, dives it down into turn one on the narrow apex, and you know, into turn one he's came in, as Seb said, he's come in like a torpedo. He's forced Seb to take evasive action, and Vettel has not seen the fact that Kimi Raikkonen was hanging around the outside of him. He's hit his teammate. Raikkonen falls to the back of the field with a slightly damaged car. Vettel takes a blow to his end plate. Like, they're both able to continue, not a big deal. Obviously, Vettel comes back to finish in second, a great super soft in to get through the field and then settle down and eventually take second over Daniil Kvyat in third for the Grand Prix. So Seb was in the wars. Raikkonen came back to finish in fifth, a good recovery from him as well. So Ferrari kind of salvaging what was a bad situation, but obviously we saw Vettel's emotions boil over in the post-race press conference in the green room. He's talking to Kvyat in Parc Fermé, and Vettel is pissed. Basically says that you came at me like a torpedo, et cetera, et cetera. You know, Kvyat was all kind of nonchalant about the whole thing, said, you know, oh, you know, Vettel was saying, oh, we could have crashed. Kvyat was like, oh, but we didn't, so it's cool. And et cetera. You know, obviously the internet jumped all over that on Kvyat, you know, and of course, you know, they gave him the pixelated glasses, fug life kind of, I don't really care, memes you'll see on the internet these days. But King, why are we talking so much about an incident that had, you know, very little effect on the actual race itself? If anything, added more entertainment to the race because of the Ferraris getting knocked down the order. And just in general, an incident that really didn't actually amount to very much.
Oh, like, if I had to put this in the most fanboy terms possible, I'd probably have to say that the reason why this gained so much traction is because of what happened in the cool down room afterwards. Is it was basically Sebastian Vettel cutting a sick promo, doing an epic heel turn back to the Sebastian of Red Bull days of old.
The multi 21 Seb.
Yeah, multi 21 Seb is back, and everyone lost their minds.
Yeah, we all know that multi 21 was arguably the most controversial moment in Sebastian Vettel's star-studded career at that point in time. He, for the first time since maybe Turkey 2010, had shown real emotion and real, you know, flustering of anger regarding actions that are taking place on track. And of course, something like this, like, we live in an era of the world, you know, where Drama Alert can get 1.2 million subscribers on YouTube because people love internet drama. And of course, like, let's be real here. Like, many people have often said, like, sport is soap opera for men. And now you can go into the, you know, gender stereotypes regarding that till the cows come home. But the point is there's an element of truth to it because we thrive on moments like this. Like, we all want to have our own two cents on incidents like this. And of course, in the era of drama and TMZ reporting and all that kind of crap, they're all going to just completely love this kind of incident happening. And Johnson, again, this really didn't amount to much, but of course, you know, it's Sebastian, one of the sport's most prominent names, you know, two sides of the same spectrum. And for me, I don't think there's any real fault to be dishing out to anyone. I think it was just a racing incident more than anything else. Like, have I got this wrong? Am I crazy? I don't think I am. I don't think I am on this one.
No, not at all. I mean, I'll be frank. I actually missed the race live, so I caught up with it post the fact, and I'd seen the backlash on Twitter. I'd seen what happened, and I thought I was expecting, you know, kind of like what Bottas did to Hamilton in Bahrain, but even worse. You know, I was expecting total dive bomb city, and I was expecting carnage. I watched the first corner unfold, and I watched Vettel touch Raikkonen and spin round. And then it was only a few corners later I went, wait a minute. What? Hang on. That thing with Vettel spinning, was that the incident that everyone was, what did Kvyat do in all that? And I actually had to go back and was like, wait, where was Kvyat in all that? And I watched, I think Formula One themselves posted on Twitter clips, onboard clips of the incident. And it's, to be honest with you, Kvyat has he's perfectly entitled. What he does, he actually backs off from going up the inside of Vettel initially because the gap's closing. Then Vettel runs wide. He goes right out because the apex of the first corner at China, it's just ever tightening. It just goes on forever. So Vettel runs wide and the gap just opens up and Kvyat goes, I'm going in it. And there's a huge chasm between him and Vettel. You could get two cars wide between them. Jason Plato would have thought that it's, you know, parting like the Red Sea, considering some of the gaps he's gone for in his career. And to me, I mean, David Coulthard absolutely nailed it on commentary. You know, did Kvyat go past him and shout boo? Because it looks like Vettel almost flinched and went left into Raikkonen. It's almost like he looked right and went, ugh! There's someone on the inside. What's going on? As if that's a surprise at these massive first corner bundles into, especially at Hermann Tilke type tracks where they have these really tight first corners. It's a total non-issue. And one more thing, I watched the rest of the race unfold, and considering some of the moves that Sebastian Vettel was pulling on other drivers, namely guys like Bottas, Kevin Magnussen, considering some of the moves he was pulling on those guys and some of the contact he was dishing out, he doesn't have a leg to stand on. I mean, come on.
Yeah, like watching the incident, it seemed like Sebastian Vettel was driving into what Ayrton Senna famously called the disappearing wedge, where, you know, you have Kvyat on the inside, obviously going for the apex. You have Kimi Raikkonen on the outside, not knowing that Kvyat's there and thinking that Sebastian Vettel's also moving back into the apex. So Kimi moves in and, you know, runs into Sebastian Vettel, who he didn't know was there.
The whole thing just seems like incidental contact to me.
Yeah.
And three guys trying to go into one apex in on a turn one situation. But of course, you know, we like drama. So it's going to be talked about. And I still.
Andre Keemstar Harrison.
Don't associate me with that asshole. But it's one of those situations where, like, I still adamant in the belief that the reason why Kvyat won driver because of that incident. I still cannot shake this because for me, I'd argue that Daniel Ricciardo was a more worthy winner of that stamp after having the puncture from the lead in on the early stages and then coming back to finish in fourth. Ricciardo himself said it was the best drive of his career. So I think Ricciardo was probably a more worthy winner. Even Sebastian, I think, had more of a claim given what happened to him on the opening lap. But of course, people think he caused the incident. So whatever. So, to the overrated beef, which was gone in about 3 minutes. It's just amazing how champagne can bring people together like that. to actual beef between Romain Grosjean and Marcus Ericsson. And
now, this King, was an unexpected heel turn.
Yeah, like, King, holy crap, Romain Grosjean went off on Marcus Ericsson.
yeah, he went off. Like, his clean quote that he gave the media was that he knew that Ericsson was on the outside of turn one, so he was on the inside and he moved up, and he said that the move from Ericsson was completely idiotic.
That's a very, like how
the PG
bad?
Version of the quote.
Like, yes.
Yeah. So, like, he actually called him a fornicating female lady parts. I think we'll call it that. I mean, that's the nicest way I could possibly put it without actually swearing. My jar is already large enough. Thank you very much. But it seems like, for me, like, I don't think there's any video of this incident. I don't think anybody was bothering to put a frigging onboard camera on Marcus Ericsson. And even so, I can't see it, so I can't comment, but to call someone an effing bleep is just seemingly a bit out of order to me, with regardless of what he did, unless he straight up killed you. Like, I don't think that, you know, saying, you know, effing and blinding and calling him that, like, it seems a bit unnecessary to me.
I mean, to be honest with you, what it feels to me is that Grosjean had a fairly miserable race. It was on his birthday, so his birthday was chat on, basically. And ever since that first contact, it must have damaged something pretty terminally, because he never made that position up. He finished 19th in the end, didn't he? He had a shocker. Yeah. So to me, it just felt like, you know,
he had the stop in pit lane to change his wing after that. That's why he's so far behind.
Yeah, there you go. So it feels to me like Grosjean had an all round dreadful race, and he wanted to take his frustration out on someone. But even so, this is weird because we all like Romain Grosjean. He's supposed to be the nice guy. When he was on the radio celebrating after Australia and getting Haas Stefan's first point, we were like, yay, this is brilliant. But this is weird. You know, the last time I heard Romain Grosjean have a proper like meltdown was when his engine blew in Singapore 2014, and he just went off. I believe part of the quote's in the intro to this podcast, actually. I cannot believe it, that bit. That's him. But that's the last time we heard him have a meltdown. What is going on? It just...
And to be fair, back then he had a good reason to be pissed. Now, here's what... shut up. I'm up to five for this episode already. Good Lord. Marcus Ericsson, after the race, said the following. He said, "I was an idiot and that I was blind and some other things. Not very mature for an adult person to do that. He screamed at me and I told him to calm down, but he didn't want to do that. Instead, he said I was a bleep and bleep and then went on to tell the media the same thing. I think it's immature, unprofessional, and disrespectful. I don't know. He was probably frustrated after having a bad race, but for him to say that to me, being a driver who's been suspended for dangerous driving and nearly losing his license, that felt a bit weird."
Oh, now, Ericsson suddenly going back to 2012 for some shade.
Ericsson decides to throw the shade to the media.
To be fair, he had a reason to in this case.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm having an angry Frenchman coming up to me, effing and blinding, telling me I'm blind, I'm sorry, I'm throwing hands at that point. I don't care about any other words. I'm throwing down at that point. Like, I will go full Paul Tracy on you and fight you in the middle of the street. Now, again, King, like, we didn't see this incident, so again, we can't really comment on the full context of it, but... there's being angry and then there's what Grosjean did. Like, I don't think you would ever like it if somebody got up to your face, said you're a fornicating lady part, and then calls you an idiot. I think, you know, you're going to be a little bit aggrieved by that at least, right?
Yes, yes. Like throwing shade would be the least of that Frenchman's concerns.
Exactly.
Let me put it this way. I had a former flatmate of mine in university pull that on me, and he ended up getting arrested for assault.
Oh, wow. The inner workings of the Johnson family life right there.
That was a fun night in university halls, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, I'll say. So yeah, that's a thing. And Grosjean, the mask has come deal of Mr. Ericsson. We'll see if that ever develops into anything more. I doubt it. But happy birthday, Grosjean. Maybe your 30th will be a little bit nicer next year. So moving on to some other major news, despite the race itself actually being fantastic. The ratings for it were not very good at all. A blog from David Nelson of the F1 Broadcasting blog. Shout out to those guys. Great people when it comes to looking for things like TV ratings and whatnot. This was the lowest audience for a United Kingdom Formula One race in a decade, King. And no matter what way you slice it, I know China is an early Grand Prix, like a 6, 7 a.m. Grand Prix for us Brits. But even so, that's... it's not a good look, is it?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a good look. Britain's boys, what, 36 points back? People don't feel like tuning in.
Yeah, it's amazing how, on paper, I think it was about 3 years ago, we started calling, you know, people like my former peers over at Pole Position. Shout out to those guys. I remember they made a very specific video back in 2014. Where they said, is Vettel killing F1 because he was winning all the time? And yeah, that was a year where Vettel won 13 times and the ratings had gone down by 100 million worldwide and everyone was saying, oh, is Vettel killing the sport? Which people didn't want to read between the lines and realize that it was because China and France had changed suppliers for or changed broadcasters, and that's the big reason why the viewership went so low. But even so, I mean, oof. The historic, according to the quote in this article, it says, unfortunately, the broader historical picture is bleak. The combined audience of 2.11 million viewers is the lowest for the Chinese Grand Prix since at least 2005. It is also the lowest audience for a Grand Prix in general since 2006. You have to go back to the 2006 Italian Grand Prix, and that was the race where Schumacher announced his retirement, wasn't it? Holy crap.
Yep.
The 2006 Italian Grand Prix to find a lower average audience. That particular race averaged just 1.86 million live on ITV. The combined peak audience of 2.94 is also the lowest since Italy 2006. And 2006 was actually a really competitive season too, if I remember correctly.
I don't want to pull the Hamilton card, but that is also, that is the last year before Hamilton entered the sport.
That is interesting. That is very, because remember, 2007 was a big year for F1. Like Vettel debuted, Hamilton debuted, Alonso went to McLaren. We had Spygate become a thing. So
it was the first post-Schumacher year.
Yeah, yep. It was the first post-Schumacher, so obviously people are going to be more curious about how the field settles. Obviously, Raikkonen, who was very popular at the time, had gone to Ferrari. You know, you had the young British hotshot in Hamilton debut, and you had Alonso in one of the biggest British teams out there. There was a lot of reasons to watch in 2007. This year, as King quite rightly says, and as we've said before, Lewis is a superstar. He's a very unique entity in Formula One, and if he's struggling and that's your meal ticket guy, no one is tuning in for Nico Rosberg.
Yeah.
Let's be honest with each other here.
And I'd probably have to add in other things like the bad PR from all the squabbles over qualifying. The rookie class is generally uninspiring this year.
Mm-hmm. Can I also throw another factor in? This weekend was something of an absolute cluster fruit cake for different series being on the same weekend. You had on one Sunday, you had Formula One, British GT at Brands Hatch, which I believe was live on Motors TV. The World Rallycross Championship in Portugal, which for the first time was live on free-to-air television in the UK. It was on Quest. They had the finals day there. You had 8+ hours of British Touring Car Championship coverage live on ITV4. You had the 6 hours of Silverstone FIWEC race, and you also had stateside, you had IMSA United Sports Car, IMSA WeatherTech Sports Cars, IndyCar, and NASCAR at Bristol. It was an absolute stacked deck of motorsport yesterday. And I think what it came down to is a lot of people went, you know what? I've been feeling a little bit disenfranchised with F1 lately. Hamilton starting from the back. It looks like he's going to have a terrible race. It's China, which has historically been probably one of the bottom three tracks on the schedule. And we've got all this other stuff going on, including the World Endurance Championship flagship event at Silverstone. I'm just not going to bother today. So I think that all conspired. And a comment on that article on the F1 broadcasting blog made a very interesting point. I hate the term casual fans. I don't like that term. However, the point was made that if any sport probably has a higher quotient of casual fans who are more likely to tune in specifically for one driver, i.e. Lewis Hamilton, if you're British fans, then it's probably Formula One. So as soon as they heard the one story coming out of qualifying was Hamilton starting at the back and it's China, they probably went, you know what? I might as well give this World Endurance Championship a try. Or, ooh, British Touring Cars are at Donington today. I'll watch that instead. So it's a little bit weird, though, how the two series that have generally had better racing across the board this year, Formula One and NASCAR, are both having like record low TV figures. It's very strange.
Yeah,
it's more
about their reputation preceding them more than anything else.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, very much so. I think, you know, with Formula One, again, you know, I think King made a strong point about the whole bad PR look. I mean, the qualifying political struggle was a real debacle, and I don't think anybody really liked
that. I think turned a lot of people off. That was the straw that broke a lot of fans' back, really.
Yeah, the qualifying fiasco was a real dog's dinner of affair, and it just exposed the true decision-making process to the world of just how bad F1 can be for this sometimes. And yeah, it was ugly, to say the least. So yeah, I mean David himself in said blog said he reckons it could get worse. He reckons there could be a race that gets less than 2 million viewers between now and the end of the season, which would be terrifying.
Especially considering we're moving up towards an era where Sky F1, the only way to watch Formula One in this country will be behind a paywall, effectively.
Yeah.
So exactly. This is including free TV figures.
So that could be a very scary prospect indeed going forward. Moving on quickly and to stuff that was outside of China again. And Rio Haryanto, we can't stop talking about this kid. And unfortunately, it's not in a positive light either. not the best F1 debut a few rounds for the young Indonesian man. And it's not set to get any better, because it turns out, King, that his seat for next year is dodgy, to say the least, so much so he's had to band together with some Indonesian telecom firms to raise a crowdfunding campaign to get his seat secure for next season.
Yeah, yeah, it's interesting that he, it seems like he's being sponsored by these firms, but these firms want, you know, a bit of marketing up front. So this crowdfunding campaign is more of, you know, a marketing campaign in crowdfunding clothing.
Mm.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Kind of like the Kurs that fills in the talk spots for the actual sponsorship investment.
Yes,
exactly. It's like, hey, you scratch me, like if you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, so to speak, in terms. Sure, we don't mind funding you, but we want a little bit of promotion for ourselves at the same time. So we'll do it this way. And it's interesting. Apparently, the thing is, in Indonesia, you if you send off a particular text, you know, they will charge you, take away from your credit, or they'll bill you for this money, and this money that they take from your. From
this is borderline
accounts.
Text £3 a month to keep Harry Anto in a ride, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like an F1 version of Oxfam here, really, isn't it? Like, yeah, text £3 a day right now, and maybe you can keep Harry Anto. He's already paid 15 million euros for it.
But I mean, like, Harry Anto had the best, like, tagline. The guy who got so many votes that F1 had to ban him from being driver of the day.
He broke the fan voting system. Can I also point out the whole fact that he's got a crowdfunder coming out now is probably not the best time, considering we found a crowdfunding campaign for him before he was even secured at Manor. And we're now entering an era where I think in general people are fairly jaded with race drivers going, I need money to go racing. Give me money, please. Like, unless it's for a legit reason, like, for example, British touring car driver Mike Bushell last year had to raise funds after he had a huge crash at Thruxton. It wasn't his fault, and it left him with a broken leg, I think. So he had to recover from injuries and get his funds back together to keep racing. And he offered things like track day passenger rides in his old Clio Cup car and things like that. So from that respect, if you're a race driver and you've had something taken away from you, then fans can go, well, do you know what? I can get behind that. That's not fair. But if you are literally just saying, I want to go racing, but I can't because money, give me money, it's starting to leave a bad taste in the mouth, isn't it?
Exactly, especially in a sport that's got such a reputation for money in the first place. They're going to,
I mean, 2 years ago, Caterham was running a crowdfunding campaign to keep the entire team together.
That was a joke. That was such a joke. Like,
exactly.
There was no positive that could have been come from this. Like, I don't care enough about Caterham to pee on them when they're on fire, let alone talk about giving them money to keep them on the grid, quite frankly. So, a lot of people did fund that Caterham crowdfunder, and to be honest with you, that looked very shady at times as well, given that they suddenly got enormous spikes in the amount of funding involved for said crowdfunder. And all of a sudden, I remember that I'm pretty sure at one point the target actually went up as well to keep them on the grid in the first place. So there was a lot of shady things about that Caterham crowdfunder that still leaves a bad taste in the mouth. And I'm not saying this one is any less legitimate, I'm sure it is, but at the same time, from what I've noticed, F1 fans didn't like a crowdfunder, and I know a lot of people have not liked the concept of crowdfunding in general. I still, you know, there's still debatable circumstances where people will draw fire with the whole concept of crowdfunding in general. And you know, I've had incidents like that before. You've gone down the crowdfunding road before, Johnson. I've had emails for people telling me that, you know, why should we back you with money? And it's like, you know, like, people want to support you, but as soon as you mention money, like, people's opinions change very quickly.
Yeah.
At least that's what I've noticed over the years. And, you know, King, when you've already paid 15 million euros for a seat due to marketing powers and the Indonesian government and their oil and whatnot, now you're asking for more I think at some point people are going to very fairly ask, are you taking the pee, quite frankly? You know, I'm getting out of here.
Yeah. I mean, it's so difficult because this is a world championship with probably like a combined net worth of $2 billion. But there's not enough money to go around for everyone to get paid to drive.
Exactly. So, you know, that's the nature of a sport that circulates a lot around large amounts of money and using that large amount of money to get your foot in the door with certain teams. So, of course, it's not going to necessarily go over well at all. That's just kind of the nature of it all, really. Now, one more, well, a couple more front stories actually before we go. We'll move on to IndyCar, I should say. Alfa Romeo. This has been talked about a little bit in teasing and in passing over the last couple of months about the possibility that Alfa Romeo might be set for a full return to Formula One as an official Ferrari B team. And these rumors seem to have gained more traction in the last week, King, where it seems like, obviously, Sergio Marchionne, the head man at Ferrari, was at the Chinese Grand Prix this weekend. And there was a few quotes that came out of him that were interesting. One of them was, you know, he was asked about the Alfa Romeo situation, and he didn't exactly deny it, King, did he?
Yeah, he didn't outright deny it, giving some credence to the rumors. And, you know, there's some smoke to be seen because Sauber is struggling financially. And that is very well known.
King, can I ask you a question, though? Earlier on this very episode, you heard me talk about the difference between no smoke without fire rumors or Audi rumors. Yeah. Is this Alfa Romeo potentially buying out Sauber? Is this another Audi to F1? Because we heard them say they were going to supply Red Bull with engines and we were going to do this. And so-and-so said something about Audi coming in. And it just, I don't know. I'm probably being cynical. It feels to me like a rerun of the Audi rumors. Is there more substance to these ones?
Well, the fact that Sergio Marchionne didn't deny them is big because he is the president of Fiat Chrysler. He runs Alfa Romeo.
Mm. So him directly not denying it or not addressing it, that's a sign. Because, I mean, there were times last year where people went, oh, they didn't deny Audi. They didn't deny it when we asked about Audi. But it was more a case of it's not even a point what we're talking about. But you think there's more substance to this one?
Yes, because he's CEO of Fiat Chrysler. He's president of Ferrari, and he denied the rumors while standing in the middle of the F1 paddock. He's involved in the sport.
Yeah, exactly. And that's not to mention, as well as this King alluded to, Sauber is in deep trouble. I mean, we saw it in February. They paid their staff late for February. Apparently, the rumors are going to Parc Fermé F1. They didn't pay them for March either on time. And that screams to me a company that has severe cash flow problems. Mm. And seemingly, I could be speculating here, but I feel like Sauber could be running hand to mouth at the moment. And that, like, the actions of paying your staff late screams to me of we have cash flow issues and that we probably...
Isn't that normally the first sign? Normally when you hear of, say, football clubs not paying their staff, isn't that the first sign that they're heading slowly towards administration? I mean, that was the first signs that the likes of Caterham and Marussia were in big trouble, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Marussia... I think it was Kota, like in 2014, I think it was the first year where that was the year when Marussia closed the doors as we knew them at the time. And they remember the rumors or the story that came out at the time at Kota that weekend was that Marussia had been living hand to mouth since Belgium after the summer break. And that, you may remember, was the weekend where Max Chilton very nearly lost his seat to Alexander Rossi, but it took a last minute bit of funding from Chilton's own family to keep him in the seat. Because Rossi was bumped out for the session, they put Chilton back in and everything seemed to be fine again for a couple of rounds. Mm-hmm. And the story was that Marussia at that point was already living hand to mouth. So any money they were getting in was immediately going back towards funding people and costs of the business. So that screams to me of a business that, again, has cash flow problems. And if you have no cash, then you're going to grind to a halt and you're going to have severe problems, like any business owner will tell you. So I think there is definitely a possibility. Now, I know we didn't talk about Sauber much, and these rumors have been going around for, I'd say, a good couple of months now, but we didn't really talk about it on the show because we felt like there wasn't much to it. The more this goes on, the more it feels like there is some smoke to this fire now. And Again, I only wish Sauber the best because, I mean, they are such a historic team. They are a key part of Formula One history. They've had over 400 Grand Prix as a team, which I think is the third most of any team ever that's no longer with us, if they were to suddenly park their doors for good. And, you know, it's a shame because I like Manisha Kelton-Bourne. I think she's a very solid team boss, and it's a shame she had the free driver scandal of last year. I was like, oh, Manisha, no. Because I always felt like she made a lot of valid points regarding the cost of the sport and, you know, the nature of how it might be a problem for people. And she seemed very level-headed and very rational regarding that, as all lawyers tend to. but again, it would be a shame if we lost them. And I can only wish Salva the best going forward. And it would be a darn shame if...
It's starting to get pretty boring, isn't it? Year after year, talking about one or two teams living on the brink, isn't it? Obviously, 2014, we had Caterham and Marussia. 2015, we had Bailiffs turning up at Lotus. You know, they were living hand to mouth for a while. It just feels to me in this era of F1 now that it's like devil take the hindmost. It's just waiting for one or two teams per year to potentially, you know, cling on and maybe fall through the trap door. And again, that's more negative PR for the sport. It doesn't look good. I mean, unless you are a Haas who are prepared, literally has the disposable income to dump X amount of millions into the sport every year, then, I mean, how many people out there are prepared to do that?
King?
But I mean, the fact that it's Sauber is a big sign that something was really wrong with the sport. Like, Sauber was the factory outfit for two manufacturers. First, I mean, most recently, BMW, obviously, and previously in sports cars as Mercedes factory team. They were, you know, the first major team for Heinz, Harald Frentzen, and Michael Schumacher.
Yeah, that's a big team, and a lot of very high profile started their careers or had a part in Sauber's history. I think Jacques Villeneuve was one of them. Felipe Massa, Kimi Raikkonen's another one. As you said, Schumacher was another big one, and Heinz-Harald Frentzen, who had a great career. So, you know, many, many great drivers have gone through Sauber's gates at some point, and it was a great outlet for a lot of very prominent and very special drivers. And again, like I said, they're a key part of F1 history, and again, it would be a darn shame to lose them. So yeah, I wish them the best going forward, and I hope that the news or the rumours circulating aren't as serious as many fear. Moving on, last major F1 story. I'll come back to F1 at the end of the show, but there's one more I want to talk about as well. And it came through today. It looks like the FOM are being a bit more draconian again, and it seems, Johnson, that they are going after dramatic pause, GIF makers. Now,
oh, those dastardly GIF makers stealing our money. They took our jobs. Yes, it is a bit like that poem I recited earlier. First, they came for the modders, and we did nothing. Then they went after Rights to Studios, and we did nothing. Now they're going after the GIF makers. And can I just say, again, gavel bashing time. This, again, just like with the modders, I know, AJ rant alert. Just with the modders, just the same thing. FOM technically has a point here. They do hold copyright and hold the intellectual property. And they obviously want to funnel everyone to the official places to watch Formula One content on F1.com and things like that. And they have every right to enforce their intellectual property and their rights. But this attitude is from somewhere around 1989, before the internet was even a thing. This is going back to the days when your parents told you that people recording music off the radio onto tape cassette was going to kill the music industry. Or, you know, the people now who in the mid-2000s told you Napster was going to kill the music industry. This is, it's just so goddamn outdated and so... What's the point in going after these people who aren't making any money off this? The modders aren't making any money off their liveries and schemes and mods. The GIF makers certainly aren't making any sodding money. Someone on Reddit is not making money off of making entertaining GIFs. And someone on Twitter made a joke about this. I think it was Marcus Hoare. They said, oh, they don't care if you're not buying a Rolex. And Nick Damon of Radio Le Mans and RCTV had the best point possible. He said, yes, but they are going after people who in future will be buying the Rolexes. And that's why this business model is so flawed. It doesn't, I just don't see what they hope to achieve here. They're not bringing anyone new into the sport. They are only driving away some of the most dedicated fans of the sport. the people who are prepared to sit around and muck around making GIFs and spend hours and hours of time unpaid just because they love the sport, making mods for these games and things like that, and going after Rights to Studios, which is a studio and games company that the sim racing community loves. And it's just so old fart,
breathe,
isn't it?
Johnson, breathe, Johnson, yeah. breathe.
Yeah, it's like we get it. We get it. They believe that, oh, they're not going to subscribe to Sky F1 if they could just watch the Grand Prix on these things called GIFs.
It's like somebody doesn't quite know what actually is that's come through and made this legislation, and they're going after the gift makers. Now, to be fair, they're not the only ones that have done this. I mentioned this on Twitter earlier today. I know famously the UFC have gone after people that have made gifts of particular fights and highlights, especially during the Ronda Rousey era, where she was knocking people about and tapping them out in 20 seconds. And you literally could put the entire fight into an Instagram video or even a Vine. And, you know, that would obviously, again, that is copyright. And again, they have every right to go after it. But should they go after it? I say no. I still argue that if people see an entertaining GIF, I'd argue they're more likely to go out of their way to actually watch it rather than saying, oh, I'm not going to bother now because I've seen it already. No, if they see it and they like it, there's a better chance they'll actually subscribe to it in future. So and, for me,
The top comment on every single thread on any popular GIF is threat is source question mark.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. The thing is, another thing we have to consider here, why is Formula One and FOM focusing so hard on taking down these forms of alternate media instead of focusing on improving their own online media presence? Because I don't know about you, I don't hear stories of the German Bundesliga doing this sort of thing, do you? I hear stories of them focusing on making their YouTube channel and their online content and their social media really, really enjoyable and rich and creative. I mean, you know, the Bundesliga is obviously the most awesome thing on the internet. But that aside,
yes.
Why isn't Formula One, you know, NASCAR, their social media people, they make their own GIFs during the race. They, you know, during the Xfinity Series races and during the Cup races, they'll throw up little GIFs during the race. WWE does it. You can watch almost entire episodes of Raw just by watching the WWE Twitter feed, and they'll throw up GIFs of all the big moments during the race in the hope that you'll go, ooh, oh my God, something just happened. That was amazing. That spot was really cool. I'll go watch that. I'll go subscribe to the network. But as I say, Formula One's attitude, it stuck somewhere in the 1980s.
Yeah, I think
it just stinks of someone at FOM went asked their grandson what a GIF is and got an ugh, granddad, you're so not down with the kids, and they went, right, we're going to take down these damn GIFs.
Yeah, go on, King.
Yeah, I think the problem with F1's, you know, method is that their market value thrives on exclusivity, not the actual quality of the content that they're shelling out. And the thing is, while, you know, the WWE has a WWE network to promote, F1 doesn't really have anything to promote. They don't sell anything to the fans except that, you know, F1 access thing, which is pretty terrible. Like, they have nothing to sell to the fans.
Timing scoring system.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And to end this segment, I will close with what NBA Commissioner Adam Silver said about the possibility of people ripping NBA content and putting it on YouTube. And Adam Silver summed it all up in three words. King knows what these three words are. Highlights are marketing. End of discussion.
There's a guy who gets on it.
Moving on to IndyCar. And IndyCar had the Grand Prix of Long Beach this past weekend, and it was a big day for the Penske yet again, as Simon Pagenaud took, the other guy at Penske, Simon Pagenaud took his first win for the Penske team in Long Beach in what was a sadly kind of lackluster sort of race. Again, I think it was, I said it was a typical Long Beach kind of race where there was a lot of close racing, but not a lot of actual overtaking and drama. And, well, when I say lack of drama, I mean it all centered around one key moment of the race. Now,
the pit exit heard around the world.
There's something enough we would say there, would you? Now, to put some context into this situation, it's the final round of pit stops. Simon Pagenaud goes the longest on his final stint. Now, he comes out of the pit lane. Now, there's a rule with the Long Beach pit exit. It's far on the left-hand side when you're coming out of the pit lane, and you're not allowed to rejoin the track or even accelerate the car until you can get at least two wheels outside of that yellow line that was on the exit of the pits. Pagenaud, I think it's very fair to say here, definitely runs at least two wheels over that line on the pit exit. And you could make the argument that it was a critical part of the race because that action was part of the reason why he was able to narrowly stay ahead of Scott Dixon and would go on to win the Grand Prix. Now, King, it's hard to talk about this one because, again, I think we're all in agreement that Pagenaud, by the letter of the law, did break the rule by putting at least two wheels over the line. But let's be real here. I think it's fair to also say it was a liberty that people were always going to exploit.
Yeah, like, let me read the quote from Race Control. According to Race Control, Pagenaud's route out of pit lane was deemed an infraction per Rule 710.1.1. Lane usage of the IndyCar penalty guidelines. Failing to follow the designated procedures, entering or exiting the pit area, including the proper use of acceleration and deceleration lanes. The penalty for this infraction ranges from a warning, the minimum, to putting a driver to the back of the field, mid, and a drive-through or stop-and-go penalty, maximum. The drivers felt that his actions were not deemed severe enough to warrant a harsher penalty than a warning, so they just issued a warning. And I get that, because you could obviously tell watching the race that the line painted there as the, you know, pit exit line is not one that's painted there for the race. It's your standard double yellow line that you see at the median of any roadway in a city.
Yeah, it's just you know, a convenient line that happened to be there already. Now that's the rule as the letter of the law in the book. Now it's up to the stewards to decide, you know, how big an infraction that was. Now there's two sides to this. And you know, there's a lot of people that are saying, oh, it's kind of a rule that everybody kind of broke, so you've got to be consistent with this punishment. And the other side, when I say other side, I mean Scott Dixon.
I mean anyone affiliated with Ganassi.
Yeah, essentially. We're saying on the other side of the camp saying, oh, you know, the rule was broken and, you know, he should be punished for it. Now, technically speaking, he was given a warning for it, but yeah. It wasn't the punishment that they wanted. They wanted Pagenaud to take probably a drive-through penalty for that infraction. Now, I know that a lot of people from the Ganassi's camp, I think it was Dixon's race engineer during the race, who said along the lines of, we were told that, you know, if anyone does it, it's going to be a penalty, etc. It's basically one great big game of he said, she said.
Of course.
And I think Pagenaud's closing line after the race was hilarious when he came out and said, I got an inch, so I'm good.
And you've got to give a shout out to Danny Brennan on Twitter. Oh, wow.
He said, and I quote, Simon Pagenaud, the only man who is... So, yeah, well done, Brennan. Well played, sir. Arguably his greatest tweet ever. For me, personally, I use the comparison to cricket. Now, cricket is a sport where I think a lot of the times the spirit of the game can take precedence over the rules of the game. Now, before the days of, you know, DRS, the other use of DRS, not the one you get in Formula One, but obviously the video replay system and, you know, third umpires these days in cricket, you know, you know any marginal calls often go upstairs. Before that, you know, sometimes the umpire would get it wrong, or, you know, the bowler is very honest enough to admit that, you know, the umpire may have got an LBW call wrong. And I've seen incidents before, like guys like Andrew Simons have been called back to the crease and to hold to bat again because the team were genuinely adamant that they felt like the umpire got it wrong, and the umpire is okay with that. It's like, yeah, okay. If you genuinely think that it was okay, we'll let it continue. And I love that sportsmanship, and I love that element of sometimes the spirit of the rules can take precedence over, you know, over the straight up hard fast what's in the book. And I think what Pagenaud and what happened with him was the perfect example of that, King. I feel like if you're going to be consistent over a liberty that everybody was kind of taking the piss out of anyway, you really can't punish Pagano just because his one may have affected the race result. At least that's what I think anyway.
Yeah, it was very difficult, wasn't it? I mean, the problem I had, I mean, obviously everyone was jumping on Twitter. The big issue we had here and the reason why there was such a sort of mob mentality about this was... the commentary team just would not drop it. My goodness. When did Paul Tracy become judge, jury, and executioner on this one? It was literally a case of, no, we need to go back. Let's have a look one more time, slow motion, zoom it right in. And I was sitting there going, that's great. We've seen five times that Simon Pagenaud has put all four wheels across the yellow line. That's great. Can you go back and find me Scott Dixon's last pit exit? Or, as it turned out after the race, some people on Twitter actually did find a bunch of other pit exits, including somebody grabbed a brilliant screenshot of... I'll try and find it briefly now on Twitter, actually. Someone actually found a screen grab. They paused it at the exact moment that Elio Castroneves was leaving the pit lane. And I'll tell you what, he turned in about a foot earlier.
And he led the majority of the race too.
Yeah,
like he was in the lead for over half three, Helio Castroneves. And again, for me, it feels like if everyone's doing it, you can't punish the guy who happens to be at the front for it. It's not like NFL Spygate where the Patriots got caught doing what everybody else did and somebody had to take the fall for it. It shouldn't be like that in an IndyCar race. Like if everybody is doing it, then you've just got to let it slide. I think the reason why Pagenaud got the warning was because it was on the hard camera for all to see in plain daylight right when Dick came out in a key moment of the race. I don't think it was worth a bigger penalty at all, because to be real, the stewards are not going to make that call. They do not want to directly influence who wins a Grand Prix. I think they knew that. And basically, if you give Pagenaud a drive-through penalty there, you've basically rigged the outcome, because we all know that at that point, the moment Pagenaud takes the penalty, Dixon's won. Because we all knew that Dixon was one of the fastest men on track that day, and Dixon would have won the Grand Prix easily if Pagenaud had gotten that drive-through penalty. So for me, King, the stewards' hands were kind of tied on this one, and I don't think there's any way on earth they could have given that penalty at all.
King, before you go on, I have found the tweet. It was from Stephanie Walcroft at 99forever on Twitter, and the exact, it's a screen grab from her television, and the brilliant thing was, she says, it's from the NBCSN highlight reel. Note, that car exiting pit lane is not Simon Pagenaud's car, because obviously it's similar liveries. It's Helio two laps earlier. Guessing this is why it was the warning. And honestly, Castroneves is turning in a good 5 feet, I'd say, before the end of the yellow line. And other people pointed out they saw the likes of Mikel Aloshin, Tony Kanaan. I thought during the race that a couple of Dixon's exits were pretty marginal. And what I found really interesting in the end... was Chip Ganassi's comments himself. It was him that was probably the most calm about it all. And he actually said he'd advocate the introduction or the reintroduction maybe of cones and something like they use in NASCAR, where they have, you know, very a whole rank of cameras along pit lane to accurately call pit penalties immediately. So something like that on pit exit would be very useful down there to make it more cut and dry. So if half the field is taking liberties down there, then half the field are flagged for penalties and it stops. So, sorry, King, go on.
Yeah, but I really feel that this is only a street circuit issue, because most of the lines drawn on street circuits are either there temporarily or just already there out of convenience, and it's not really a measure of what a proper pit exit should be, because if you actually followed the double yellow down to the end and turned, you'd really lose a lot of time that you really shouldn't be losing under any circumstance.
Not to mention, if we're being consistent with this whole thing, why the hell wasn't Max Chilton given a penalty for blatantly turn five occasions? Like Max Chilton, like he was shameless about this. He had, like, he said themselves that the cut in the white line rule would not apply for this Grand Prix. So on like three or four occasions, Chilton just straight up cut the corner and was almost able to pass guys because of it, and he was given a warning from the stewards, don't do that again, you naughty boy.
He basically just took his own line through turn five, didn't he?
Exactly. Yep. He just took his own line through it, cut the corner blatantly, no penalty. So the stewards just kind of let everything go on this one, which is probably the way it should have done. So for me, personally, like, Pagano's kicks is a complete non-factor, and I think the stewards made the right decision, in my opinion, to let the win stand for SP. And speaking of which, like I said, it was his first Penske win, King, and I know we talked about this a lot on our IndyCar season preview of Sarah Connors, shout out to her as ever, and we mentioned that Pagano seemed to be about 90% there from his Schmidt-Peterson days, where he was a genuine title threat with one of the lower teams, and he's been sensational so far this season, King. And it looks like Pagano has really gotten it all together this year.
Yeah, like I mentioned it in the St. Petersburg review, how Roger Penske said if Pagano didn't improve, he was going to get fired, because apparently the bottom guy at the end of the year is going to get fired at Penske.
Wow.
And Pagano didn't want to be that guy.
Like, this aura of being the fourth wheel when with this superpower team of Will Power, who was reigning champion last year, and obviously a ridiculously good driver. Monty, again, ridiculously good driver. Helio, IndyCar series legend, no matter which way you look at it, and one of the greatest drivers the series has ever had. So Pagano was kind of like the fourth wheel and, like, basically the mouse with three very big cats around him on, like, the world's darkest episode of Tom and Jerry at this point in time. So for Pagano to get it all together and now for him to be outright points leader, Johnson, is a great turnaround. And again, we've always known Pagano's had this potential, but it's awesome to see it come to light, really, isn't it? Especially given, like, as we said before, he's kind of been labelled as the fourth Penske guy and the odd one out, so to speak.
Yeah, this is a great step up for Pagano, and it's great to see him, like, really step up like this. It's clear that he's had the rocket from Penske, and when you get a rocket from Roger Penske, you step up. There is no option other than that. I mean, this is a guy who had no qualms with ditching Kurt Busch as soon as he started to act up in the NASCAR operation. This is a guy who is prepared to... You know, Penske has a rich history of winning and making the calls that he needs to. And when you've got a guy who just missed out on the title last year, Juan Pablo Montoya, you've got Helio Castroneves, one of the biggest characters in the sport, one of the most successful, and Will Power, you know, a championship threat every single year, pretty much. It's tough to come into that operation as the fourth wheel. It is so difficult. But Pagano, you know, Penske's sitting there going, no, it's not. I hired you because you're a race winner and I believe you can win me championships. If you don't, you're fired. It doesn't matter who's in the other cars. You're here to deliver. So he probably explained that to him in no uncertain terms in the off-season. And, you know, Pagano has always had good form in terms of race winners. It's not like he's not possible in doing this. He's a race winner in IndyCar before. Going back to his sports car days, he used to be very, very strong in the American Le Mans series. And he was a regular race winner there in the old Acura LMP2 cars. And, of course, he was part of the Peugeot LMP1 team at Le Mans for several years. And I believe tasted success at Le Sarthe as well. So this is a proven driver. He's very, very good. So I think Penske probably sat him down more with a tone of, you know what? I know you can do better than this. It doesn't matter who's in the other cars. I know you can win races and championships, potentially. It's time to show me. Probably the whole show me or you're fired thing was pretty extreme, but hey, seems to have done the trick, right?
It seems to have done the trick, and we all know that Roger Penske is a man of incredible standard, and he holds himself to incredibly high regard, and deservedly so. He's a winner, and he only wants to employ winners, and that's why he employed Pagano in the first place. So great for Pagano, and I'm sure it'll be the first of many more under the Penske umbrella. The guy's a stud driver. I said it before, he's one of the great all-rounders in the series. He's like Monty. He's just strong everywhere. At this point, and if he can get the pack racing down on ovals, he is going to be sensational, and I'm glad that he is starting to put it all together at last. Now, one of the big talking points coming out of IndyCar in the last week or so, in fact, actually, I'd argue for the last month or so, has been the battle between Chevrolet and Honda and the aero kits, and it seemed to have another negative effect on this race, Johnson, as it was Joseph Newgarden, Graham Rahal, James Hinchcliffe, and Tony Kanaan all came out against having this high downforce setup at Long Beach, where there was, again, you were able to run close, but you were not able to overtake, or very rarely were you able to overtake outside of the push-to-pass feature. Obviously, that's a key part of the series, Johnson, and it looks like the drivers, I think, have started to have enough of this, of the direction that IndyCar is going in with these very, very, you know, over the top, you could argue, an excessive downforce elements in these aero kits.
Well, this is interesting, isn't it? Because this backlash really started around Phoenix, and there was talk already that the aero kits were proving unpopular in the garage area, adding additional cost, you know, not adding much in terms of actual racing quality. You know, when some people like, I remember Will Power and Scott Dixon raised concerns about it last year, about the dirty air issue, and we all sort of scoffed and went, hang on a minute, 2015 was one of the best years of IndyCar racing in years. It was an absolutely awesome year. It feels like this year, I don't know, the aero kits are starting to lose their luster. And what's interesting about this is, I actually had a discussion with IndyCar driver Pippa Mann on Twitter about this. Massive friend of the show as well.
She chewed you out. Let's be honest here. She threw the shade at you, Johnson.
I'll clarify this because I happened to tweet about that was, you know, I happened to say, so that's four drivers now taking a crap on this race. And she corrected with, I think you'll find it's more like offering, you know, she kind of clarified me because she thought I was throwing shade at the drivers for being so negative about the race. My fault. It was poor wording. My bad. I'll hold my hands up. It's fine. I'm never normally one who calls out drivers for being critical. And she made the point of saying they weren't explicitly calling for downforce to be lowered, but too much downforce has now gone to the top side. This is the age-old discussion about downforce on top full of winglets and that causing dirty air versus downforce created bottom side on the underneath the car through ground effect and things like that. And, you know, these current aero kits have gone too far with producing downforce on the top side. More downforce needs to go away from the top and down to the bottom where dirty air is less of an issue with downforce created down there. And this, you know, this is an issue that's been apparent in Formula One for many, many years. NASCAR has recently been dealing with the issue of high downforce causing dirty air. And it's interesting how it's causing different sets of problems. At Phoenix, it meant the cars were going so, so fast. It was borderline unsafe at a mile oval like Phoenix. And tough to pass. At Long Beach, it just meant it was so tough to pass. And it's interesting because I looked up the various layouts of the Long Beach Grand Prix layout, and back in the mid-90s, if anything, they ran an even shorter, even faster layout than they do now. They basically ignored the fountain section, and they had, you know, rather than the definitive left-right turn 6 and 7, they had a fast left-right kink straight onto the back boulevard. And this being caught in the 90s, they had super fast cars, but they didn't have as much topside aero, so they could still pass. They could still run side by side. And those races were pretty entertaining, even though there were even less definitive passing zones than there are now. So I feel like with that many drivers, you know, drivers with real authority and real clout in the series, like Kanaan, like Hinchcliffe, like Newgarden, like Graham Rahal, you know, these guys know all about close IndyCar racing and what's, you know, I generally trust the drivers. If they say certain things need to be done to improve the racing, hell, they're the guys out there doing it. So if, and it was almost consecutive. It was like everyone interviewed after the race, it was the same thing coming up. It was one of two things. Number one, the race needs to be longer. So it's definitely a three stop rather than some guys going two stop and trying to save fuel the whole way, very much an F1 type problem, or you know, cut downforce from the top side, maybe put more into the low side so you have less dirty air and you can actually make passes. Because I mean, for Long Beach it was a pretty good race, but even so, you know, when you've got that many drivers saying, hey, we tried but this race wasn't good, it's I kind of enjoyed how, you know, as Pippa made the point, they weren't, you know, just taking a dump on the race. They were being, you know, constructive about it. They were saying, look, it wasn't a great race. Here's how we can improve. We want things to be better for the fans. And NASCAR was in a very similar situation last year. You know, the drivers were coming up week after week saying, look, we need to cut downforce out of these things. NASCAR actually tried going a different route. They went for high drag, which if anything was even worse. It was horrific, the two races they tried out there. And they went, you know what? All right, you drivers, believe it or not, the drivers know best about how the cars drive. What's the surprise? And they cut downforce for this year. And generally so far, the results have been very good. So I feel like IndyCar 2017 could be fairly similar to NASCAR 2016. But either way, Dre, do you see the aero kit experiment lasting much longer beyond this year? Because I don't.
I think we're going to reach a breaking point soon. And I think the breaking point might be the Indy, which is not that far away now.
The Indy 500 is close, isn't it? And yeah, we're already having controversies about underside parts for that, aren't we?
Yeah, there's already talk about, you know, dome skids, about the Indy 500 and the fear that might be, you know, and to talk about Chevrolet, potentially the conspiracy of Chevrolet could be sandbagging their own package to not allow Honda to get as much time to develop, to try and catch up in the spirit of competition. And I know Robin Miller was very active about this on racer.com. He made a big article talking about how he felt like, you know, why should Honda be allowed to catch up? You know, it's the spirit of motorsport, the best car wins, etc.
Absolutely.
So for me, I think that the negativity in the camp has grown exponentially in the last month or so. And I feel like it's going to reach critical mass soon, King. And I don't know what vibe you're getting, but that's how I look at it, at least.
Yeah, I mean, it's competition what got us here. The fact that you've had Chevy and Honda develop aero kits with these cars to try to get as much downforce as possible means that these cars can't race against each other. Dallara built a good spec DW12 that can race each other well. And manufacturers coming in to try to squeeze out as much performance as they could. Yes, while the cars are much, much faster now, they can't race each other as well as they used to.
And what's fascinating to me is, again, going back to, you know, your mid-90s car, I don't want to sound like one of those old nostalgic guys who are still mourning the death of Champ Car. But what's interesting to me there is that was full-blown manufacturer wars. You had tyre wars going on. You had loads of different engine and chassis manufacturers, you know, Dallara, Reynard, you know, Mercedes and Ford and loads of other. I think Honda and Toyota were supplying engines back then. You had a lot of different guys in there. But generally, you know, you look at the cars back then, there wasn't a huge amount of downforce topside. You know, they had big wings and everything. Of course, they were generating a lot. They were quick cars, but they had very powerful engines. But generally, they could race each other for the most part. And you got some classic racing. I mean, look at Portland 1997. They were three wide across the line when Mark Blundell won his first kart race. That was unbelievable. So, you know, I'm not saying obviously every race was like that from that era. But my point is, you can have fast cars, but, you know, with sufficient lack of dirty air to make racing possible. And I think King's absolutely right. The DW12 was a great base platform to work from. And it's almost like we've now opened Pandora's box. People are looking for that outright speed at the cost of raceability. And so far we've had issues like excessive debris, you know, parts coming off easily, you know, speeds on some of the shorter ovals where they're using the road course high downforce aero kits to be just way too fast to be competitive. And just sheer dirty air problems with race. I mean, the Long Beach race went by, it felt like it was 5 minutes. It just went bing, and there it is. The race was over. No wonder some of the drivers saying, look, we need to make this thing longer. If we're going this fast in the race, a two-stop 80-lap Long Beach race just ain't cutting it. It just went by like a flash.
It didn't help. There was no caution. Like, it was the first Long Beach race, I believe, in 27 years that was caution-free. It was the first cautionless Long Beach Grand Prix since 1989 was the last time that there was a caution-free Long Beach. So again, it was over in barely an hour and a half, which is again average F1 speed, which is not what IndyCar is. IndyCar tends to have 2 to 3 hour races normally, especially on the bigger oval tracks. So for that time, it happened is, again, it was over in a flash. Next thing you know, I'm getting ready for bed. Overall, I think there's definitely a lot of negative air in the air, pardon the pun there, regarding IndyCar's aero kits. And I think something may have to be done soon because, again, the voices, like, it was willpower at first a few months ago who said, you know, we should have more power in the cars and less downforce. And now we've had multiple big prominent drivers in the series come out and say, yeah, this kit might be a problem. And again, something may need to be done about it. So yeah, that is a thing. And I'm just about going to wrap the show up there, believe it or not. I'm going to save the esports discussion for next week because I think there's a lot of potential in that and I want to save it for next week. As ever, you can follow all the three of us on Twitter. Adam Johnson at AJ_Bombersports, Ryan King at Ryan Eric King, and me at Harrison101HD. You can also check us out on YouTube for highlights and exclusive content every once in a while as well on youtube.com/motorsport101. And if you really like us, why not back us on Patreon at patreon.com/motorsport101. Of course, we are also on iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn as well. So you really have no excuse not to listen to us and adore us to your heart's content. So until next week's episode, I've been Andre Harrison. He's been Adam Johnson and Ryan King. I'll catch you guys next time. Sayonara.
mate.
I can't look for
you. You are the world champion.
Oh, God, I'm just imagining the esports episode next week, just starting off. I'm not a Cody's guy. I'm not an iRacing guy. I'm the guy.